Hello, and welcome to this reading of one of my stories. My name's Graham Lamb, and this is the short story, At Night I Heard the Shells. It is a very rough and ready reading, just while I'm testing out some equipment ahead of properly recording the audiobook, probably in about 2 months' time. And this story is mostly finished. There may be a few little things I change before it finds its way into the final book. But here we go, anyway, and I hope you enjoy it. At Night I Heard the Shells by Graham Lamb. 1. Those words still haunt me now. When the rest has gone and the finer details are hard to remember of the story I am about to tell you, those words remain. They will always remain. I mean, my God, why wouldn't they? The way they stay with me, haunt me, fester in my dreams. His voice caught in my mind, the way he would look over at me, and with eyes growing ever distant as he spoke to me, only me, on those nights when I never slept. At night I heard the shells flying overhead. 2. When the ward lights went down just after 8 p.m, the shift changed and the television in the corner softened to a pale indifferent glow, the ward changed shape around us. You could sometimes hear the machines humming away like distant insects, the bustle of the changeover from day to night staff as they moved with the quiet effectiveness of people who had learned to move with swift efficiency and purpose. And the beds themselves became islands, lost and adrift in a gigantic ocean. I had been in the hospital for a week by then, gradually undergoing the humiliating tests that would confirm the diagnosis I had received when hospitalised during a school trip some 6 months previously. The hospital had a way of making time feel thin, irrelevant, measurable only by the regular routines of medications and visits. I honestly think that was where my fear of needles came from, the angst every morning when the phlebotomist visited the ward, wondering whether I would be picked or left alone. I was 15, the only child on an adult ward, and for the first time in my life, nearly scared out of my wits. Charlie was in the bed opposite mine in our four-bed bay. Others came and went during our time together. I remember Les, or was it Len, who had lost a leg to diabetes and was on his way to losing the other. There may have been others, although they are now lost to me in time, cast adrift as so many of the memories of our youth. Charlie, though, I remember well. He was 87, or so he claimed, small and frail now as a sparrow, with the face that looked mapped and explored from the rich experience of his life. Lines where laughter had once been, and then much deeper lines where sorrow had settled and found a forever home. I was soon to find out where those lines had started. He had been admitted to the ward the day after I arrived, and at first I thought he was just another old man who liked to talk. Then, on the third night, after the ward had gone quiet and the lights had been dimmed, he turned his head and looked at me with eyes that were startlingly clear. And from his expression, even before he spoke, I should have known. I should have known. "You awake, lad?" he asked. I was. He knew that, but he was polite. The tests of earlier that day and the boredom of being mostly bedbound had given way to a kind of alertness that only hospital nights have. "Yeah," I said. "You?" He smiled. "At night I hear the shells," he said. "You want to hear about them?" Back then, when I was young and naive, I did more than anything. Now, I'm not so sure. And I've sometimes wondered whether I should have said no, if only for the sake of my dreams. I had read about the Battle of the Somme in school. We all had. Right about the time we learnt about the war poets. Wilfred Owen, mostly, he was from around our way, and I still drive past a road named after him every few weeks, and remember Charlie, and those damn shells. All I learnt then was dates, diagrams, and the way teachers said things like the cost was terrible, and then moved on. Those lessons were facts on a page, something distant. Everything else, everything important, I learned from Charlie's voice as it made the past a room I could step into, a voice that reminded me of the bullet heads that longed to muzzle in the hearts of lads. Yes, I said. Please. He folded his yellow woolen blanket, a gift from his daughter, over his knees and turned his face towards the window. Outside, a car passed and the sound was swallowed up by the hospital's walls. Inside, his voice filled the space between us. I was 18, not much older than you, he said. 18 and thinking I was brave. Thinking I knew everything, even the future. They told us we'd be home by Christmas. I'm sure you were taught that. You believe that when you're young. You believe anything that keeps the fear from taking hold of you and pulling you onto the mist to be lost forever. He spoke slowly as if each sentence had to be dug out and set down carefully, lest it be shattered forever or lost to time. He told me about the train to the coast, the smell of coal and wet wool, the way the countryside blurred past like a painting smeared by rain. He told me about the first night in France, the cold that wasn't just weather, but a thing that crept into your bones and made you small and weak. We marched, he said. We sang. Singing made the miles shorter. We sang about girls and pubs and the things we thought we'd do when it was over. Singing was a kind of defiance. It was a way to say we were still ourselves. It was a way to keep at bay what was ahead of us. When he began to speak of the trenches, his hands moved as if shaping the earth. They were like open, gaping mouths, ready to swallow you up whole, he said. You climbed down into them and the world above you became a different country, as you wondered whether you would ever get out of them safely. The mud was everywhere. It got into your boots, into your rations, into your letters. You learned to live with it because you had to. You learned to make jokes about it because if you didn't laugh, you'd cry, and if you couldn't cry, you'd go insane. Many did. Charlie told me about the first time he saw a man die. He didn't dramatise it, but neither did he sanitise it for the scared but fascinated young boy opposite him. He said it like a fact, like the sky is blue or the grass is green. We were in a small, temporary trench with a roof over it, he said. And the shell came in and took the roof clean off. There was a boy, no older than me, I don't remember his name, sitting on a crate. He was holding a photograph. When the dust had settled, he was gone, or as gone as anyone could be when bits of him were still around and all over. The photograph was still there somehow, face down in the mud. I picked it up. It was a woman with a hat. I kept that photograph for a long time. I don't know why. Maybe because it was the only thing that didn't belong to the war. The war took so much. I asked him if he had been scared. As soon as the words were out of my mouth, I realised what a stupid, insensitive question it was. But once words are out, there's no return for them. He laughed a short, surprised sound. Scared? Of course. But fear is a strange thing. Sometimes it sits in your stomach like a stone and you can feel it all the time. Other times it goes away because you're too busy to notice it. The worst is when it comes back at night, when the shells start. At night I heard the shells flying overhead, hearing them go over, hoping and praying they would continue on their journey and not pay me a visit. 3. He told me about the first day of the battle as if it were a long, terrible day that had no edges, a beginning with no end. We were sent over the top, he said. They told us the artillery had softened them up. They told us the wire had been cut. They told us the machine guns had been silenced. They told us a lot of things. It was all bullshit to get us to move. We climbed out and we walked. At first it felt like a parade. Men were singing. Then the ground opened up and hell came along to play. Men fell. The air was full of sound, whistles, shouts, the thud of shells. I saw a friend, Billy, go down. He had a smile on his face. I don't know why. Maybe he was thinking of home. Maybe he was thinking of nothing at all. I don't know which is better or worse. Charlie paused and for a moment the world was only the two of us and the soft beeping of monitors. I could see the pain of the memory in his face, the way his mouth tightened and his eyes went to a place I couldn't follow. I could also see his need to tell this story, to pass it on to a new generation. It wasn't a want. He clearly didn't want to remember this, but he felt that he needed to. Afterwards, he said, we crawled back. The mud had swallowed so much up. Boots, rifles, men. There were bodies everywhere. You learned to step over them like stepping over stones. You learned to keep your hands clean, because if you touch too much, you go mad. We buried some. We left some. There wasn't time. There wasn't room. Charlie told me about letters. We wrote letters like prayers, he said. We wrote to mothers and sweethearts and sisters and brothers. We wrote about the weather, the food, and the things that made us laugh. We didn't write about the things we couldn't write about. Sometimes the censor cut out whole paragraphs. Sometimes the censor didn't need to. You could tell by the way a man folded his letter whether he had seen something he couldn't tell. I asked him if he ever wanted to run away. He looked at me as if the question surprised him. Run away? He said. Where would I have gone? The world was smaller then. The only place that felt safe was the trench. Isn't that madness in itself? The only place that felt like home was the company of the men who were with you. You couldn't run away from them. You couldn't run away from yourself. He spoke of the nights when the shells came like a rain of iron. They made a sound like the sea, he said. A long, low moan and then a crack. You could feel the ground move under you. Sometimes it landed close and the trench shook and the candles went out. We would lie there in the dark, listen to the shells and count. Counting kept your mind busy. You counted the seconds between the whistle and the explosion. You counted the breaths of the man next to you. You counted the things you had left. You counted the nights you had survived. Charlie told me about a night when the shelling was so close the mud around the trench seemed to boil. We had a lad, Joe, who used to hum to himself, he said. He hummed the same tune all the time. That night when the shells were coming, he hummed louder and louder until he couldn't. Then he started to laugh. It was a small, wild laugh. He laughed until he couldn't breathe. We thought he was mad. Later, when the shelling stopped, we found him curled up like a child, and he was dead. He'd laughed himself to death. Or maybe the shell had done it. I don't know. Sometimes the mind breaks in ways you can't see until it's too late. The invisible fractures getting bigger and spreading out until they break up the insides. He told me about the smell. People talk about mud and blood, he said. They don't talk enough about the smell. It was a smell of iron and rot and wet wool. It was the stench of things that had once been alive and now were not. It clung to you and you could never wash it away. Even now when I smell rain on the pavement, sometimes I think of that smell. And I'm back there. And I'm young again. And I'm 18. And the world is a place that can be taken from you in a moment. I asked him cautiously if he had killed anyone. He looked at me for a long time, and I could see the question turning in his mind like a pebble in the stream. Yes, he said finally. I did. Not because I wanted to, but because that was what you were there for. You don't think about it when you're young. You think about the glory and the medals. Then you see a man with a face too much like yours and you pull the trigger and you hope he dies quickly. Afterwards, you don't speak of it. You don't tell your mother, you don't tell your sweetheart. You put it in a box and you lock it away and you carry it with you. He told me about a moment when he and another soldier were trapped in the shell hole and the other man began to cry. He was a big fellow, Charlie said. He'd been a miner before the war. He had hands like shovels. He started to cry like a child. I didn't know what to do. I put my hand on his shoulder and I said, it's all right, son. He looked at me and said, don't call me son. He was 30. He had a wife and a baby. He died the next day. I still think of him when I see miners on television. I think of the way his hands were like tools and the way he laughed when he told jokes about the pit. 4. Sometimes when Charlie spoke, he would stop and look at me as if measuring my face for understanding. "You know," he said once, "people think war is about battles. It's not. It's about the small things. It's about sharing a crust of bread with a man who has nothing. It's about the way someone will give you their last cigarette, even though they need it more than you. It's about the way a man will hold your hand when you are shaking. Those are the things that keep you alive." He told me about the day he was wounded. "It was a small thing, really," he said. "Splinter of shrapnel in my leg. It bled a lot and I thought that I was going to die. They took me to a field hospital and a woman with steady hands sewed me up. She gave me a cup of tea and a biscuit. I remember thinking, this is what heaven is like. Then I was sent back to England on a hospital train. The train smelled of disinfectant and old men. I lay there and I watched the countryside speed by and I thought of home. I thought of my mother making stew. I thought of the woman in the photograph I'd kept. When I got home, the town had changed. People looked at us like we were different. And I suppose we were. In some ways now, we were foreigners in our own country. They didn't know how to speak to us. They didn't know what to say. We had lost part of our common language. He told me about the medals. They pinned them on my chest and I felt foolish, he said. I didn't feel like a hero. I felt like a man who had been lucky to come back. The medals were heavy. They clinked when I walked. I kept them in a drawer for a long time. Then I gave them away. I gave them to a museum. I thought it was the right thing to do. I didn't want them around me. There's no pride in wearing something that someone had to die for you to get. Not really. We pretend that survival is something to be proud of. It's not always better to have lived than to have died. Medals earned like that are more symbols of death than they are of life. As he spoke, the ward's night sounds became a kind of chorus to his memories. The beep of a monitor, the distant footsteps of a nurse, the soft rustle of sheets. Once a young man in the next bay over began to cry quietly and Charlie's voice softened. "Don't be ashamed of crying," he said. "Crying is a way of keeping the heart from breaking." I asked him if he'd ever forgiven himself. He looked at me as if the question had weight. "Forgiveness is a strange thing," he said. "You can forgive others. You can forgive the generals, the politicians and the men who sent us. But forgiving yourself is harder. You carry things. You carry the faces of the men who died and of those you killed. You carry the things you did and the things you didn't do. Sometimes you think you've forgiven yourself, and then something small, like the smell of rain, brings it all back." He told me about the years after the war, about the jobs he took and the women he loved. He married once, briefly, and the marriage ended quietly, as I learned later many things do. He had children, he said, but they had their own lives and their own ways of dealing with a father who sometimes woke in the night and called out names from a time before. "They are good children," he said. "They tried. But you can't make someone understand what you won't tell them. I couldn't tell them. I was too close and it would break them." 5. Charlie told me about the day he came to the hospital. "I fell in the garden," he said. "I broke my hip. They put me here. First I was angry. I thought, not now, not when I'm old. But then I met you, lad, and I thought, maybe it's not so bad. People come and go. Nurses are kind. The food isn't terrible most of the time. And at night when the ward is quiet, I can tell you the story. It keeps me company." I told him I wanted to know what he thought about the war now after all these years. He looked at me and his eyes were very clear. "I think it's a terrible thing," he said. "I think we were young and foolish and we were used. But I also think there were moments of beauty. There were men who shared their last biscuit. There were sunsets that made the mud look like gold. There were friendships that lasted a lifetime. You can't put it all in one box. You can't say it was only horror or only glory. It was both." He reached into the drawer by the side of his bed and took out a small folded scrap of paper. "I keep this," he said. It's a list of names, men I knew, men I loved. I read it sometimes. It helps me remember them as people, not as numbers. Would you like to see? I nodded. He handed me the paper and I unfolded it carefully, reverently, as one handles an old text of incalculable value and worth. The handwriting was small and neat, the hand of a young man who had learned to write in a different world. There were names and nicknames and a few notes. Billy, liked to whistle. Joe, miner. Tommy, afraid of the dark. I traced the letters with my finger and felt a strange closeness to men I'd never met. Do you ever dream about them? I asked. Every night, Charlie said. Sometimes they come to me as they were, laughing and young. Sometimes they come as they are now, and I'm the one who is young. Dreams are a way the mind tries to make sense, but they are not always kind to us. We sat in silence for a while, the kind of silence that's full of things unspoken, unbidden, a darkness afraid to fully reveal itself. Outside, an ambulance siren wailed and then faded. The night nurse checked the charts and moved on. The ward settled again into its rhythm. Tell me about the shells, I said finally. You said at night you hear them. He smiled a small, tired smile. The shells are the thing that never left, he said. They are the sound that marks the time. When I was young, they were real. They came from the sky and they made the earth shake. Now they are in my head. Sometimes I wake and I think I can hear them. Sometimes I wake and I think I can smell the mud. It's like a film that plays when the lights go out. He told me about the way the shells made him feel alive and dead at the same time. When the shells came, everything narrowed, he said. You're only yourself and the breath in your chest. You didn't think about tomorrow. You didn't think about the future. You thought about the next second. There's a clarity in that, a terrible clarity. It teaches you what matters. It teaches you that a hand held in the dark is worth more than a medal. I asked him if he regretted anything. He looked at me and his face softened. I regret that I didn't tell some people I love them, he said. I regret that I didn't write more letters to my mother. I regret that I didn't dance more. Regret is a heavy thing. You can carry it or put it down. I've tried to put it down, but it's hard to let go of and walk away from. Charlie told me that sometimes he wished he could go back and change things, but then he would think of the men who had been with him, and he would know that changing one thing would change everything. You can't pick and choose, he said. You can't say, if only I'd done this, then that wouldn't have happened. Life is a terribly tangled web. You tug one thread and the whole thing shifts around, and you never know whether you're making it better or worse. As the night deepened, his voice grew softer. He told me about that last day he spent in France, more about the train that took him away and the way the fields looked like a patchwork quilt. I remember a woman in a doorway, he said. She was holding a child. She looked at us and she didn't look angry. She looked tired. I thought then that the world would go on. I thought then that maybe we would learn. We didn't. We did it all again, didn't we? Some of us came back and had children who we lost a second time around. When he finished, he lay back and closed his eyes. The ward was very still. I felt older than my 15 years, as if the story had put a weight on my heart that I hadn't had before. I thought of the boys in the photographs at school, of the dates and the maps, the way we remembered those who had died in the yearly chapel service. And I realised how small those things were compared to the life in Charlie's voice. Why did you tell me this? I asked, not far from tears. He opened his eyes and looked at me. Because someone should, he said. Because the young need to know. Because if we don't tell the stories, they become numbers and not people. And because at night when the shells come, I like to have someone to tell them to. I stayed awake with him until the early hours. We talked about small things, football, the taste of hospital tea, the way the moon looked through the window. He told jokes older than me that my mother would not approve of, and I laughed because it felt right, even if I didn't always fully understand them. 6. There were more stories the next night and the next. Sometimes he told the same stories and sometimes he told new ones. Sometimes he fell asleep mid-sentence and I would sit and watch his chest rise and fall and think of the men on his list. A few days later, one afternoon, I came back to the bed after some more tests in the distant part of the hospital, and the bed opposite mine was empty. Neatly made and Charlie's possessions gone. I felt a small, sharp panic, as if someone had taken a piece of me. A nurse told me gently that Charlie had been moved to another ward for further tests, as they'd found a problem with his heart. I went to the other ward and found him by a window looking out at the hospital garden. "You're late," he said, with a grin. "I'm sorry," I said. "I thought you were gone." He waved a hand. "Not yet," he said. "Not yet." We sat and watched the light move across the garden. He told me about the goose he had stolen but couldn't convince himself to kill, and about a man who had taught him to whittle. He told me about the time he had danced with a girl at a village fair and how her hair smelled of lavender. He told me how his wife had laughed when he tried to sing. He told me about the small, ordinary things that had made his life. 7. A week later, he was gone. It was quiet and sudden. Just one evening after supper, he drifted away. I'm told that he looked peaceful, as if he had finally found a place where the whistle of the shells overhead was only a memory. At his funeral, there were only a few people. Some family, a couple of nurses, and me. So many had gone before. We stood in the church and the vicar spoke words that were both old and new. I thought of the men on Charlie's lists and of the boys who had gone over the top and never come back. I thought of the whistling of the shells overhead and the mud. Years later, when my time in the hospital is but a fading memory and the world has moved on, I still sometimes hear the shells. They come in the quiet moments, in the smell of rain, in the sudden flash of a memory. When they come, I think of Charlie and the way he told his story to me. I think of the way he said that war was not only about battles, but about the small things that make us human. I tell the story now to my friends, my family, to anyone who will listen. I tell it because Charlie asked me to. Because he said the young needed to know. I tell it because the men on his list were people, not numbers. I tell it because at night when the shells come, it helps to have someone to tell them to. Sometimes when the house is quiet and the moon is big, I sit by the window and listen. The world is mostly peaceful now, but the shells are a memory that lives in the bones of those who were there, and in the stories they passed on. I close my eyes and I can hear them, a long, low moan and then a crack. And I remember a man who shared his nights with me on a hospital ward and taught me that the most important thing is to remember the story.